This is Barry Tyker of the University Oral History Project. Today is the 17th of December, 1991. I'm with Cliff Thompson again. This is part two of our interview. And we're going to talk a little bit about fundraising in the law school. Could you begin by giving us a background on what fundraising had been before you came to UW?
Well, the fundraising effort at the law school was an early effort, earlier than most law schools, but it had, in effect, quieted down over a period of 20 or 30 years. And so it was at a low ebb compared to other law schools. We had had a group called the Ventures, which were alums who were supportive of the law school in general, and the dean in particular, who would give a certain amount of money each year. And I think that came to something like $40,000, and with some effort, they might collect more than $40,000. But that was a very low amount compared to most law schools, whether private or public. The other area was that there had never been an endowment or capital campaign, and that actually got underway under the leadership of Dean Halstead the year before I came. So that campaign had been announced, and a goal set of about $3 million when I came in 1983. So the two things I aimed to do was to increase substantially the annual giving, an amount that you would be getting every year and be able to spend on your annual budget. And secondly was to make the endowment campaign a success. And the end of that was that the annual giving, we got up to at least $250,000, $300,000 a year. And the endowment campaign, which ended a couple of years before my deanship ended, in which we'd aimed at $3 million, we got well over $7 million. So both went well. And I think that was the side of, we talked last time about my two goals of trying to get the disparate parts of faculty living together more congenially, and I suppose that's the peace campaign, and this other was the prosperity campaign. And the reason for peace and prosperity, of course, was that I think was probably implicit in what we talked about before, always in the gargoyle, but I think to with those things, you could restore Wisconsin to a national level effort, meaning that what we were doing in the law and society area was really amongst the top efforts in the United States, that we were giving real leadership. And part of that was keeping the top people who were on our faculty and had the ability to make that kind of contribution. People like Mark Galander in particular, I think, because on two different occasions, by a variety of means, but would have been impossible without the added resources, we were able to keep him here, despite very nice tenure offers from Columbia University in New York, Pennsylvania, and so on. So we were able to keep him. The other area in which we hope to do something, and which I think, Barry, you said you wanted to talk about today, was in the area of keeping Wisconsin's strong tradition in advancing minority participation in law training.
Before we get into affirmative action, just a few other brief questions on the fundraising aspect. Did you bring in a fundraiser, someone specifically to raise funds?
Not at first, because you can't afford it. The endowment campaign, the capital campaign, we were assisted tremendously by David Utley, who was assigned by the University of Wisconsin Foundation and had been assigned to that project before I came. And he was given to us, I think, on a half-time basis or a three-quarter time for at least the first year. And that was paid for on whatever the ratio was out of the foundation's funds and what we were able to collect for the endowment campaign. So the endowment campaign got off to a good start. I mean, that was the first big effort I jumped into and had Dave's help on that. And that makes a tremendous amount of difference, because you have to have somebody who's doing your organizing and making the initial contacts. Really, it's Well, and then I should say that the difficulty on after that campaign was underway, he returned to the foundation, was only 25% with us. So the problem of getting sufficient staff support for the annual giving was then the big problem. And the problem is that until you're bringing in enough money to spend a lot of money hiring someone, you can't hire them and the entire job falls on the dean. So the beginning periods of that are extremely difficult in terms of the amount of time it takes. I think that I cite the fact that Minnesota, which had a very good program, they were ahead of us, and UCLA, which is also ahead of us, both of the deans of those schools said that they spent about half time on fundraising and that they should probably be spending more. Now, when I'm trying to do various things within the faculty at the same time to get this fundraising off the ground and without support, that was a period in which it was quite difficult. After we were bringing in enough money, then we were able to hire our own full-time person, a person we got with the help in terms of selecting the person from the alumni group. We hired Chris Richards, who I worked with just, I guess, a year and a half before I concluded my deanship, and he was made a tremendous amount of difference. I think the analogy is that it's in fundraising, it's like a political campaign, and the dean is like the political candidate, and meaning that the candidate has to be willing to go anywhere, anytime, and make the pitch, but you really don't want to be the one organizing the rally and organizing the make sure a crowd is there to hear the speech and so on. You've got to have staff for that. And until we had the staff, it was tremendously draining, and it was a nervous made one nervous because you're spending a lot of time. You don't know if it will come back in. The good side of all this is that because it was a result actually of the fact that we had not gotten into modern fundraising and at an earlier period, was that there was plenty of examples to follow. The techniques of how you raise money had been well developed. So it wasn't like we had to create we had to reinvent, we didn't have to reinvent the methods of fundraising. You could use, you know, modifying them, but use the types of things that have been done at schools all over the country. And Minnesota was ahead of us and was a help in terms of guidance.
So by fundraising, especially in the early first few years, it meant really literally going out on the stump and talking to all the alumni groups around the state and the country?
Well, I think it still means that, and I don't think that easily ever ends for the dean. Your private schools have always, Northwestern, Harvard, and so on, have always had to be into fundraising. But in the last two decades, your really great public schools, and Virginia I would put in that category, have gotten into private fundraising. So it's absolutely essential, and in a sense it never ends. I can remember hearing a dean from one of the Midwestern schools saying, a new dean saying, well, I've been out, and the alumni were so appreciative they hadn't seen the dean around the state and all these places in so many years. And he said, now that I've done that, he says, of course, other people can go. And I chatted with him after, and I said, no, you might skip a year, but they do expect to see the dean. There's no easy substitute for that. You can't delegate the actual conduct. And I think the other thing that you can't delegate entirely is that I think it's a mistake, and I've seen this happen in many schools, where they start fundraising and too quickly the dean is asking for money, for contributions. In other words, you've got to set the framework for that. You've got to set the mood has to be right before you ask. On the other hand, what I've also seen is that you can't schmaltz around forever, that at some point you have to ask. In other words, there are certain alums that if they're going to give, it's because the dean personally has asked them to give. And so, and you don't want to ask for too little. You don't want to get a yes too rapidly. So you both have to have a time in which the setting is made right. And then the dean herself or himself has to actually ask for the money.
So it's a delicate balance.
Oh, yes, always.
When to ask and then... how much to ask.
Right, yeah. And that, and you need good staff work for that, which again is, it's very difficult when you're being, when you're trying on a political campaign to both be your campaign manager and to be the candidate. You have, that period was the worst period for me.
Now you're starting to get your monies rolling in, you have your development officer in place. And again, this is mentioned, covered in gargoyle somewhat, but what did this money go toward? We have a building program that's, is that a direct result of the...
The fundraising, we've talked about private fundraising, but the, in a sense, equally crucial talking about fundraising, and we've been talking actually about private fundraising, you know, from our alums and other members of the public who are supportive to us, but I actually call that private fundraising. That's what we've really been talking about. But public fundraising, in the sense of increasing the appropriation from the state, was equally crucial and was a large part of the effort. And I guess the biggest parts of that were that the first possibilities for a major increase in our budget were came about because of an enactment of something called catch-up, and that is that the legislature was providing money so that the university could, quote, catch-up, unquote, with peer schools, meaning the Big Ten and other schools with whom we consider ourselves peer, such as Berkeley and other schools. And in that regard, one of the big victories was to convince the Chancellor Shane to do something that had never been done at Wisconsin before. And then that was then continued by Chancellor Shalala, who was also a strong supporter of this. And that is that the law school did receive more than its proportionate share of the catch-up. In other words, law school salaries tend to be a bit larger, so the great danger in the first instance is that if you got catch-up money, they'd say, well, the law school salaries are already fairly large, so we don't need to help you. Whereas at a minimum, I wanted no less than what would be going to other schools, but truth is what I fought for and in the end achieved was because our difference between ourselves and other law schools was greater than, or I was able to show with a great deal of difficulty over a period of time and having my statistics double-checked and triple-checked, that we were able to show that we were worse off proportionally and that therefore, in terms of the purpose of the catch-up, we were deserving of more than our proportionate share of that, and that's what we got. And that, once that was done, it was done twice over two big catch-ups. Then, with that kind of money, a number of things could follow. One is that we could make competitive bids to keep our faculty who were being, where people were trying to lure away our faculty. It had never been the policy at the University of Wisconsin Law School to try to keep them by offering some kind of competitive counter package. They're just sort of, well, if you're being offered more by Columbia University or UCLA, then, you know, either love us or leave us, but we won't certainly pay you a penny more. Whereas what I thought was essential is that we do, as other departments, I think the top departments in Wisconsin, such as sociology, have done this for a long time. That is, they're willing not to match the offer from elsewhere, you can't do that, but to provide some sort of a counter package. And that policy was the only policy that I ever initiated without getting the approval of the faculty in advance. And what I did was get the approval over, it took me a semester to do it, but I got the approval of the Academic Planning Council, which we talked about last time, first. And then when I had a track record of keeping three people who were amongst our top people, after we kept those with that track record and at a time when no particular person was being bid upon by other universities, spent a semester discussing the issue generally with faculty, and the faculty approved that, and the dean to this day has that potential, has that capacity to try and make counteroffers, which is would have been impossible to do the political aspect of that within the faculty without having had the state finances increased. Now, the other side of the state finances was the building campaign. The building process is very slow at the university. We had sort of been trying to get some kind of a building addition for years, and the short of the story is that we got into that political process, and by the time I'd left, we'd had the new, we'd gotten on the top priority list of the university for a new building addition, and an amount had been figured out, and even a $500,000 sum for planning had been approved by the chancellor and was in the process of being approved by the state. So that we've got coming up a major contribution from the state, to which private funds will also have to be attached in order to have a building. The other public funding, that is state funding, that was tremendously increased was that my second priority after getting up faculty salaries in a way that was respectable was to go after helping our library. And that's a long story, but has what a part of it that I like very much, because people refer to it as the miracle part, which is that I actually got the student body after a long campaign, meaning conversations with not every member of the student body, but awfully, it seemed sometimes that we'd talk to virtually everyone personally, but we got the students to vote for a tuition increase that would go solely for the library. And why it was considered a miracle was that I was told by the vice president, Tranny, he said, well, I think if you have them phase it in after they leave, maybe they'll vote for it, but not otherwise. But they actually voted to increase their own tuition, meaning it was increased immediately. Yeah. And it was close. I think the vote of the student body is the biggest turnout they've ever had for elections of officers or anything. But I think we had something like 600 or 700 of the 800 undergraduate, well, of the non-master's degree candidates voting, and I think we won by 13 votes. And then the elected officers, I had hoped at one time that the elected officers would be the body that would decide this, because I thought I could convince them. I didn't think the student body would ever vote, you know, to increase its own taxes, in effect. Mm-hmm. But actually, we got it. And then I think the vote of the student officers was only 1 or 2 of 15 were against it, and the rest were for it. So we got this huge increase in our library budget. And what we got was actually twice the amount we thought we were going to get, because one thing that I'd not been able to use as part of that campaign was the possibility that the chancellor would match the amount that we brought in by our own tuition as kind of a reward. In other words, she would take money from general tuition increases outside the law school and add it to our library if we could get our own students to increase their tuition. And I couldn't use that argument because it was too unsettled. The issue was unsettled. Mm-hmm. But in fact, after we'd gotten the increase, the chancellor did give that match. So we had a total increase of about $420,000 as a permanent increase. Plus, every year we'll have an increase due to inflation. So that was the second and major public increase in our budget. So both private and public had to be done together. And in fact, you know, one plays on the other. That people don't give money to a law school because it's in a bad condition. I've seen law schools make the, you know, we're in terrible shape, please give us money. Your alums want to give you money because you're top drawer, and because that the money they give can give you that margin of excellence. That's the cliche, really, that law schools and probably other institutions use, and certainly we used and used successfully.
Now, in your deanship, Jerry Thain was telling me the other day that I believe it's the ranking, is that the right term for it, for the UW Law School went from 92nd to at 1.26?
Well, the not rankings, the rankings, there's no official rankings. In fact, I think the ABA quite rightly says that these are dangerous and misleading, although we tend to be ranked by anybody who does them, whether it's Newsweek or other places. We tend to be ranked in the upper 20, 25 schools. We sometimes joke we're one of 50 schools that likes to be ranked, who think we're in the upper 10. But I think, because of our law and society orientation and our dedication to diversity in society, that we're one of the top law schools. I'd put us among the top 5. But I think most people, without real hesitation, I think they're always amazed that we do so much with so little, but they would put University of Wisconsin in the top 20, 25. Now, the 92nd figure was actually a figure relating to where we were in our salaries, our average or mean salaries. The salaries of our faculty had hovered for many years around 50, which is not that bad, given that it's relatively easier to live in Madison than in many bigger metropolitan area, so that we were in 50 of the 175 law schools. It was not all that bad. It's not great, but it's not all that bad. But we'd gone down to 92nd, and as the result of that catch-up funding, which I told you about, we came into the 30s in terms of salaries. And that made it possible to do lots of things that we couldn't do before, including, I think most importantly, without everybody's salary being moved back to a respectable level, you wouldn't have been able to make special efforts on the parts of those who were being given outstanding competitive offers from other schools. In other words, if the entire faculty hadn't have had its salary improved overall, I couldn't have made the fight, I think, successfully to make special treatment for a few others. Now, that also goes for an important part of the funding from private sources that came in the endowment was named professorships, and that's covered in the GARCO. We went from about 4 to, I think, in my time, we added 12 or 13, and in fact, there were 10 more that we'd funded, which were available for the new dean and faculty to appoint, or to save some of it, as I felt should be done, although I left that decision for the new incumbent, to be used as a general fund for funding faculty research without adding additional name chairs. So we certainly added over 20 named professorship capacity for 20 professors additional.
I'd like to switch now for just a few moments and talk about one of the most talked about things on campus today, the affirmative action policies. I'd like to gear it specifically to the law school. When you came to the law school, when you arrived at UW, what was the law school policy at that point concerning affirmative action as it related to the enrollment of women, blacks, and other minorities? Okay.
In regard to affirmative action, I think it's important. I would say that the record of the University of Wisconsin Law School is outstanding. I think in regard to some of the things we've talked about, Barry, I've immodestly felt that I could never do it publicly, Wilding, but the truth is I really do feel that what I planned to do wouldn't or might not have been done without my intervention. But in this area, I think it's really important to say that I was a strong supporter of an existing policy. I think the record of this faculty has been extraordinary over many, many decades. And one of the many reasons for that, well, it goes way back. Certainly even in the 30s, where we added the famous John Stuart Curie painting, Emancipation, that was a painting that's to this day in the old library room of the law school. That painting was rejected in Washington as being too radical because it showed freed black persons, freed slaves, standing with their legs over the fallen soldiers of the North and South. Today, it doesn't look at all radical. In fact, some people think it's much too old-fashioned, don't like it for that reason. But that was brought by Dean Garrison. That painting was brought to the law school back in the 30s. I mean, we've had a strong record in that area. And I think in the modern era, probably Professor Jim Jones, who is himself a black American, African-American descent, has been just a dynamic driving force in the country, in the nation, and certainly in this law school. He started, now it's going on 20 years ago, but I used to say 15 years ago, but I guess it's going on 20 years ago. He started the so-called Hasty Fellowships, named after a very famous black judge, Judge Hasty. And this had as its specific purpose to bring disadvantaged people in general and black people in particular into the possibility of entering the quarters of power of legal teaching profession. And we had very little money, but we set aside enough for one fellowship every year. And these people would come in. They would be people with good records, but records that probably wouldn't, on the face of it, get them a hiring at a law school faculty. And they'd be given a tough master's degree assignment to do an important piece of written work. Not all of them achieved it. But those who did, then by that achievement, they both had a paper credential then, that is the master's degree in law from Wisconsin. And then, and also, you know, in a sense, equally or more important, the experience of doing writing, seeing that they could do it, which is essential if you're going to be a successful professional academic. They would have done that and they got hired. And now there's so many, you see the Hasty brochure, we have so many leading American law profs that came out of the Hasty program. And that goes back to the genius of Jim Jones. So when I came here, this faculty had, well, in terms of, I don't think we were any more progressive than a good number of schools, but certainly women had always been admitted to the University of Wisconsin. I mean, which is interesting contrast to say, well, say in the 30s, there were always 3, 4, or 5 women in most classes, never more, but there were always that. Whereas at Harvard, for example, didn't have a woman in the law school to 1951 or 52, and that was true of a number of leading schools. We were early in that, and we were early in having encouraging minorities, both on the faculty and as students. Now, I think probably what I was doing in Africa had a strong parallel. That is, what we were doing in Africa when I was over there from 60 to 73 was helping with state law, with the state law schools, that is the national law schools, to provide an educational system that would bring people into the corridors of power, into the highest levels of government. And really, that's the whole point, I think, in a nation like America, where we're pluralistic and we have a number of minority races. The way we're going to be successful, is that people from the minorities have a share in the power, a share in the responsibility. And they don't have that, can't have that, if they don't have the specialist training. And so the role of the law school is to bring, give the opportunity to those who didn't have that power before to have it, women and minorities. And Wisconsin had a tremendous record, and so I was very proud to be associated with that record, and certainly it was a high priority with me. And when we, I think it was 88 or 89, we received the national award. They give one award every, the society, public teachers, no, it's called the American Association, Society of American Law Teachers, SALT, is an organization of American law teachers which annually gives an award of achievement to a person or an institution for doing something that they consider outstanding. In 80, I believe it was in 88 or 89, that award, the annual award, went to the University of Wisconsin Law School for having hired more than a token number of minority law professors. We hired 4 outstanding people who happen to also be minorities. Mm-hmm. Now, that ability to hire that number came about from 2 things. One is that Chancellor Shalala took a chance, in my view, a big chance, in using certain funds to, in a creative way, to try and increase diversity within the campus. And we benefited by that because, not because we said, oh great, there's some money, we can now hire a minority. We had for the whole time I'd been here, for the whole period way before I was here, had very strong contacts with potential candidates to this school. We had a terrific network of potential people we'd loved to have hired should the money ever come available, or when the money came available, going after them. And so when suddenly money was available, it wasn't like we had to start looking. We just had dozens, in effect, of outstanding names on our list, and so we went after them. And because we were able to hire these people, we were given, you know, not one, but in the end, 4 new positions, and got 4 outstanding people. But the thing I want to emphasize, I guess I have said that this, my role there was not as the quiet innovator, but as a very vocal supporter of a very consistent and strong faculty policy.
Have any of the Hasty Fellow Award winners or any of the other black or women UW law graduates come back? Have they come back and taught some of the positions?
Well, actually, one of the first graduates is our current dean. Dan Bernstein was a Hasty fellow brought in by the Jim Jones program. And of course, I think one of the reasons there's two big reasons that Dan got to be dean, which don't have anything about, you know, doing with the fact that he's a minority. One is that he was a member of our faculty, and so people know him and know whether they knew they could trust him as opposed to wondered if they could trust him. And secondly is he'd actually gone off to Howard and was serving as a dean. But his start in legal education came through the Hasty program. And the truth is there's a number of people we wish we could get back. There's some that we've lost to other places. Kim Crenshaw, was a Hasty fellow, is now teaching at UCLA. So some we've been able, I mean, we're happy basically where they are going out and being, as they have been, outstanding members of the law teaching profession. I think one of the little known facts about our faculty, I know it's little known even amongst the faculty, because I did a study to see how many of our graduates were in law teaching, not aiming at how many were minorities, but just how many of our graduates were in teaching. And I asked faculty, and faculty would try to think of those that they knew, and most people would say, well, 2 or 3 or 5 or 6. We have over 100. Oh, my. Over 100 of our graduates are in accredited law schools teaching.
That really covers what I had to say about affirmative action. Do you have any other?
Oh, I'm sure there's other things that if I could see a transcript of this, I'd love to add, but I haven't a thing to say to you.
Just a reminder to whoever may be listening, the Gargoyle article, which we referred several times, will be in the file folder for Cliff Thompson in the UW Oral History Project office. And also, anyone who has not seen the Johnson paper in the law school,
yes, you must go see
it. It is really spectacular. And the Bitter Beer.
Thank you very much, Barry.